Welcome to FMI's Built In. I'm Scott Winstead, FMI Consulting President. I'm excited to share my conversation with Brian Skipper, Corporate Director of Project Development at Hensel Phelps, with you today. Brian plays a pivotal role in shaping the company's strategic direction with a particular focus on the semiconductor and mission-critical sectors. With over two decades at Hensel Phelps, Brian has held a range of leadership roles helping to drive growth, innovation, and long-term success for the firm. His expertise spans project development, strategic planning, and building the kind of partnerships that really move the needle. In this episode, we explore how Hensel Phelps is navigating the fast-changing construction landscape while maintaining a disciplined approach to growth and innovation. Brian also unpacks how Hensel Phelps prioritizes where to play, what to pursue, and how to say no, even to good opportunities in service of a focused growth strategy. Whether you're focused on strategy, growth, or leading teams at scale, this is a conversation you definitely don't want to miss. Let's dive in. Brian, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks, Scott. I really appreciate the time.
I want to go back to something we talked about in our last conversation that you said that really stuck with me, which is that the speed of change is as slow as it's ever going to be today, and that technology is as dumb as it's ever going to be today. I'm curious how you see that playing out at Hensel Phelps today.
Yeah, so as a large general contractor, nationwide focused with people coming into the market and looking at where we're trying to go, technology is at the forefront of everything that we're doing on a daily basis. We're trying to innovate. We're trying to be more efficient. We're also trying to make sure we're not too leading edge. For us, we're trying to figure out when we adopt and how we adopt. Our biggest things is our frontline individuals and how can they accept the technology we're bringing to them and how does it help their jobs. And so for us, we're trying to make sure we're doing it smartly, but we're also making sure we're communicating wisely to everyone that it's not going to slow down. So either we get part of this train or we're going to get left behind. And so we have a lot of systems in place to strategically roll out technology and to make sure it's as efficient as possible that we started to craft the last couple of years. But yeah, I mean, it's at the forefront of everything. If you don't wake up in the morning and say the word AI three times when you get out of the shower, it just comes at you just at all places and everything you do. We're not misaligned to that. Construction's a little lagging compared to other industries. But overall, if you're not paying attention to it right now, in a couple of years, you're going to be left behind.
You just talked about being leading edge. So I'm curious, how do you kind of walk that fine line between leading edge and not falling off the edge?
It's tough. It's really tough. I mean, especially you have innovators in an organization like ours, people join a company to innovate. For us, where we look at is where the moments of impact can truly happen near term and pilot it properly and do different cohorts with, honestly, other individuals in the industry that some might consider competitors, but we look at them as competimates. We have an industry technology push happening, not just a Hensel Phelps one general contractor technology push. So for us, we've even stood up other ventures within the company. And so we actually stood up a group called Diverge, and they're an innovation and venture capital arm of Hensel Phelps. We actually focus on real-time job site challenges and figure out how we can take technology and processes and kind of lead them forward. So we actually have this cohort group that's really been stood up with an innovation center now that can then pre-vet some of these technologies and come along for the ride as these new VCs and startups are coming along. And so we can make sure it's smart growth and we can pilot with them to then bring it to the industry. And then on the back end of that, we're actually bringing in other general contractors of similar standing as ours in the industry, because again, we're solving an industry problem, not a Hensel Phelps problem, of how we can deploy these technologies the right way. And so that's what we're doing today.
So you mentioned several things that I want to go deeper on. Say more, Brian, if you would, about competimates.
Rankings go up and down every year, but we're going to be a $9 billion organization this year, mainly focused within the US market space nationwide. And so we look at other firms that are of similar size in that ENR top 15 amongst different subsectors, and we bring them around the table. A lot of them have their own technology teams or technology arms that they're trying to innovate with. And so we get around and we have a round table every so often that we all invite each other around the table and we have those conversations. So I say competimates because we are in the business of trying to win and secure more work as competitors, but we're competimates because there's an industry thing going on right now to properly roll out this technology. And if all of us are supporting certain ones or understanding where the misalignment is happening and lessons learned happening along the way, it makes us all a little bit more efficient. And so that's where we try to go with that.
So the concept of piloting properly inside of Hensel Phelps, what does that look like and how do you ensure that happens?
If you ask someone a question, they will always give you an answer. And so if you ask someone, what's a technology you like to use, they will inherently give you one or 20 answers very quickly. And so we have a process in-house to kind of deep dive those, put them in through a queue, or we go through governance with that. And then after the governance perspective is, we figure out where those champions of change are going to happen and pilot those locally, regionally, get the business case going, and then roll out those lessons learned at an enterprise level. And then we roll out through internal and external comms as needed to make sure it's as efficient as possible, because it's one thing to put 6 months of effort to roll out a program or a tool. If no one on the back end wants to adopt it, well, then we've just rolled out something for 6 months just to put it on a shelf. So that's the last thing any of us want to have happen.
You know, one of the things that you and I talked about before was this concept, our four pillars of good strategy: focus, choice, systems, and mindsets. One of the things that we talk a lot about is resources aren't infinite. You have to kill as much as you create. There's all these things that you could do. I'm curious how you all think through the filtering process to pick the right things to innovate around.
It's a good question. Some of it's luck. Some of it is trial and error. But frankly, we look at how many individuals it will impact, how fast it can get deployed. Is it something we build versus buy? That's a conversation we have quite often. I think a lot of organizations are in that same boat. There's times when we're like, are we a construction company that has a technology arm? Are we a technology company that builds construction? To not layer in technology as an arm would put us out of business, frankly. And so for us, we look at how many individuals will be positively impacted by that, and then we go that direction, because the funnel is ever growing and there's definitely always things in the queue that are being parked right now. And so when we're up against the deadlines of, okay, if we need to roll this out today, who's it going to impact and how? Because if we don't roll it out pretty quickly, we all know technology is changing. So if it takes us 9 months to iterate, to get it perfectly right and set up, someone else could already built it in the market space and it could already been deployed. And so that build versus buy mentality, we figure out where we should focus based on the moments of impact with our people.
Given the speed of change that we've talked about, love to know a little bit more about how you ensure the strategy that you're shaping at the enterprise level actually translates into the decisions and the actions at the business unit, at the local project level.
There's so many metrics out there. We're now teetering over 5,000 employees. We're creeping up to the $10 billion mark as an enterprise. And when you start getting to some of those levels, that whole enterprise mindset, national mindset starts to shift and evolve, and how you can get back down to the tangible needs of still the business users and business case at the front lines. And so for us, we're starting to grow our corporate resources to make sure we're communicating and discipling out kind of some of the information, but we're still keeping the true heart of what we are. I mean, when I joined Hensel Phelps 17 years ago, it was a very entrepreneurial mindset. It was a large organization that had a small local feel, and staying true to those roots. I mean, we're still in the same corporate headquarters we've been since the 1950s, still very humble beginnings, and keep that mindset of making sure we're targeting and communicating effectively to their front lines, but still letting them be that balance of entrepreneurial spirit. And so when you think strategy and speed of where we're trying to go, we're just trying to layer in some additional information to make sure we're pointing directionally right. That's a term we use quite often. Are we directionally going in the right direction? Because in our business, things change very quickly, very quickly. If you're too rigid and you don't have that just directional right of where you're trying to go and give yourself some outcome, every day is going to feel like you're bouncing a ball in a different direction.
Just to pivot a little bit, I'm curious how you've developed the discipline to walk away from good but possibly misaligned opportunities as an organization.
To say it's easy would be false. It's not. But where our firm and our roots truly, in my opinion, really differentiates kind of how we handle the market space right now is we have some checks and balances to have some good business processes. We make sure we bring in a small cohort to kind of review some of these, we'll call them more sticky situations that we might be looking at. And so when you take more of that agnostic approach, it really helps align us a little bit stronger. There's definitely been some situations where there's been some good faith efforts on both our side and the client. Contractual arrangements start to come more into focus, and we realize there's some misalignment to the point where we need to have those serious conversations. And ultimately, we're trying to win good work, but we're trying to perform good work as well, because to do something one time is not a good recipe for our business. And so when we go into a situation where something contractually or performance-wise or scope isn't clarified in a way that we feel like we can perform the right way, then we have to make that unfortunate call to be respectful that, hey, this might be a short-term pain point for that client, but longer term, it'd be better than us drag this thing out.
So Can you share a time when saying no turned out to be the right decision in hindsight, even though it probably didn't feel good in the moment?
Yeah, and I'll definitely keep some of the specifics out of the mix in case they're listening right now. We worked on it was a competitive bid, competitive pursuit. It was an innovative type approach and in the water wastewater sphere for an industrial client. And when we got into it, what we learned is that client was growing their own contractual side and their business planning side. And so as they were bringing on new individuals, they were changing the rules a little bit along the way. When it came into focus that we were going to secure the project after working on it for 8 months, it was going to be a quality project for us, in our opinion. But as they brought on additional individuals, what we learned quickly is that those individuals want to change up the structure of the deal. And not only did liquidated damages come into place, but so did consequential damages and long-term ways that we couldn't feel comfortable. And so we outlined those to the best of our ability and ultimately walked away. And then looking back on it now, a couple years later, I won't say the exact time frame again, but a couple years later, the job hasn't moved forward. And so not only did us as an individual in the market space not agree to those terms, no one else has either. And so it's those situations where you, at the time, it's really tough. At the time, there was follow-on work with said client potentially that we walked away from before them asking us to, like, hey, based on this going on, we're going to step away for a minute. But understanding that not only from the market sounding, we look at those kind of things. Well, who else accepted those kind of terms? And we learned that as a market, no one did.
So shifting gears a little bit, I'd love to talk about diversification along two fronts. One, what does ideal diversification look like for Hensel Phelps in today's market?
So we are creatures of learned behaviors. And so I say that because the average tenure of a person in Hensel Phelps is 13 to 14 years in the organization. I've been here a little over 17. And I say that just because we learned some things from the past. And so the 2008, 2010 mark, we were heavily focused on certain market sectors. And then when the bubble happened, we learned that with the work drying up, those clients were definitely ensuring that the ones that had the strongest relationships ties with, that they were keeping them whole. And so for us, we were less diversified at that point. And I say that because today we want to make sure that never happens again. So right now we're spread across 13 different market sectors. We're trying to make sure we're not too far leaning in any one. There's not a perfect science to it because as soon as you say there's a perfect science, there's this really great opportunity with good upside for a different client that might not perfectly make sense. But if we drew a hard and fast number, some might say between 25 and 30% would be probably as high as we want to go in one market sector. And then from there, we have a bunch of sectors that are in that 10% range. As I start saying all the percentages, people on listening might start doing the math and say, well, you're over 100% there. So something doesn't equal. And so I'll just leave it at, we don't want to be over 30% in one as of today.
So, keeping on the topic of diversification, how does this apply to trade partners in your thinking?
Again, being a national group, we're able to pull in and, let's just say the word out loud, data centers, they draw a lot of resources in that advanced manufacturing space. So in the current climate, we're talking about reshoring or onshoring a lot more of that advanced tech space. So all of it's kind of pulling from the same group of people, whether it's a data center, a pharma job, a semi job, they're all pulling from that similar cohort of people. So for us, obviously, we only can understand the book of business that we're part of with our trade partners. And so we take a hard look. Not only are we evaluating viability, how are things were going in certain areas of the country? Maybe when they were having to relocate to some part, it just didn't work as well because the connectivity didn't make sense relationship-wise. But we want to make sure we're not putting our trade partners in harm's way. And we say that because when something's going really well, you want to keep doing it. You want to keep doing it. But sometimes you do it so long that you put something that was really good into a place that it's not going so well. And you've actually forced a trade partner into a situation where they took on this work in good faith because we have this strong relationship. It's going to work out just like the last four did. But there's some capacity constraints on both sides, or the rules of engagement might have changed. So for us, we're starting to track that more. Now, granted, we only can see again our book of business, but we're trying to be aligned with that and be smart with them on it and tell them, like, hey, for these three, let's go this direction. For these other two, let's make sure we step away to make sure that you have the right capacity because we want both sides to make sure it's fruitful.
That concept of being numb to risk is, I mean, that was one of the big features of our Why Contractors Fail study from 18 years ago. It's the mind of the contractor, right? It's that entrepreneurial DNA. And we've pulled so many things from the fire so many times. We'll do it again this time. It'll work out. And then it does until it doesn't that one time. It's easy to kind of get numb to the risk and just fall back on the muscle memory of working with the same folks that have done so well and performed so well over the years.
Agreed. I guess one other quick comment that I feel like I'm having quite often right now with prospective clients and repeat clients is, once you factor in the Hensel Phelps brand and, you know, what we can provide, and once you factor in the market conditions for the cost of materials and things like that, the critical point right now, from my vantage point, is the labor constraint. It's there. And so people could just look up a little bit, look up and look out is what I keep telling some of my clients, because right now we can get to a dollar value, most likely within range. We can get to a schedule within range. But what we can't get is, there's three more just like you that called me this week that want the exact same thing in the exact same geographic location because of tax incentives, whatever they think, power, energy, water, utility, infrastructure. And so when I bring that up each time, they all pause and say, can we talk more about that? Which surprises me because it's what we deal with. But for them, it's one of one. This is their crown jewel. It's their one of one job. They have a mission. They're going to attack it. But for us, it's like, your one of one is one of many that are very similar going on. And it's the same resource pool you're asking to have.
Going back to what you shared earlier about the rule of thumb, 25 to 30%, ideally, you don't want more than 30% exposure in any one particular sector. Love to kind of take that thread and talk about how you evaluate and prioritize new sectors or new markets for investment.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'd give you a little bit of a shout out. We definitely use some of your materials for, you know, those emerging markets and things that are going. But we also lean in with our clients and figure out where their minds are heading, where the investments are going. And so for us, it's the energy power sector. It's the water wastewater sector that we truly see. And then right now we're focusing on the flavor of the year right now is the reshoring, onshoring of new potential innovative manufacturing facilities that are coming to the market space. You know, a couple of years ago, it was focusing on tax differentiation and how those things could be propped up. Some might say it's the carrot or the stick. I feel like it was the carrot a little bit before. And right now it might be the stick with some of the current administration's tactics. But when we're studying those things and looking at new markets, not only are we looking at new verticals and new regions, but even in that 25 to 30% makeup of a market sector, diversification could be by client. And so we don't put all of our eggs in just one client. So for us, diversification in the data center market, let's say we want to creep over that 30% because the market's hot, that's the right business strategy, we have the right resources, the right common values with that said client. We want to make sure that we're not all 30% with one client.
So on that thread, what criteria helps you determine if it's a market that's worth entering or it's more of a distraction?
We have a couple rubrics. We have a playbook that we've created to try to standardize some of those questions. You know, it comes down to what the strength of that market is, as far as what the demand is showing right now and the longevity of it. We look at what market sectors we're naturally strategically aligned with when we're trying to decide if that's something we want to play in. That's more regionally focused. Obviously, if it's an emerging market from a build perspective, it's the chicken or the egg. The client wants to understand that you have the reputation to do the job. Well, it's an emerging market for us, so we obviously don't have a ton of work exposure in that market sector yet. That's why it's emerging. And so we figure out where the parallels are. So for example, ranking-wise, we're doing a lot of work in aviation. We're the number one aviation builder for the last 14 years. It's just one of those things that we've been very fortunate to secure that kind of work and have clients that want to bring us back. So let's just take the power energy market sector from it. Okay, well, we're trying to look at power energy. Well, where's the aviation market going to go in the power energy sector? Are they going to try to go near grid, off grid? What redundancy things do they have? Do they have infrastructure water needs? So we try to take something that we've already established ourselves in with a client type, with a similar build type, and figure out what those parallels are. Advanced manufacturing, there's a lot of subsectors there. Maybe some of those we're not as strong in today, but we can lean on the processes, the build, the logistics, the site management, the type of build overall. I think that's probably the biggest thing for us and the hurdle. And then, like everyone else would say, it's growing our people at the right pace. Because last thing I want to do is to go in an emerging market and stub our toe a bit where they don't want to invite us back.
Let's kind of build on that thread. It wouldn't be a conversation with a leader from Hensel Phelps without talking about the customer journey, and the client experience. So Brian, I'd love it if you would talk about what that actually looks like inside Hensel Phelps.
Absolutely. Hensel Phelps started in 1937. The average S&P 500 company lasts less than 25 years once they're listed. And we want to be a 100-year company and beyond. And so that 100-year mark for us is going to be in 2037. And so we've set out the last couple of years to create some enterprise strategies in order to get that North Star vision of where we're trying to be. And contractor choice is one of them. There are options. especially the clients we prefer to work with, are the ones that want to look at those and not be a commodity-based decision. And so when we say that customer experience for us, right now we're starting with our clients and focusing on that and rolling out a national program to all of our clients. And it's from a curiosity listening standpoint. It's interesting. You know, we have these structured meetings, you have structured ways to have conversation, but tackling at moments of impact and having just the opportunity for them to just let the guard down, have a conversation, let's figure out some of those little nuances, are making great impacts already. So we rolled this program out about a year ago for us at more of an enterprise level. We might've had pockets of other ways of doing it in the past. It's been very interesting. And what the thing that we're promoting it and why we're talking about it so much is it's frankly not a marketing ploy. It's to make sure we're getting aligned with the clients we want to be aligned with. And when we're not, having the conversation quickly and early to determine, hey, for both sides, is this a long-term venture that we both want to go down? Because just like we have choices, so do they. And want to make sure that it gets that alignment. So we're really excited about where it's heading and just being curious and listening right now.
Continuing on there, how do you all think about ensuring a consistently high quality experience across regions, project types, and delivery teams for an organization that is clips 9 billion on the way to 10 and beyond? Just talk about that a little bit.
It's tough. It takes effort from all sides. And we have 10 regions and business units spread throughout the U.S. You follow the waterway from the Mid-Atlantic area south and all the way around through Texas and up through California. And then we have one dot in the middle of the U.S. in Colorado. And so being spread out that far, what we've learned is over the years, we might have been more regionalized with our clients and our focus. That web is closing in, filling in, I call it. Our clients are doing the same thing. And so we have clients that have central hubs that are deciding work throughout the U.S. So for us, part of the reason why it's working is because the demand is there for it. It's a requirement. In the past, if we had pockets or situations that are more regionally focused with client X, operating with client X in a different region was totally a different group of team members. But now it's all interwoven. And so for us, we brought on a systematic approach to document some of these discussions and figure out how, when we're going to communicate with that client going forward, are they getting the same experience, that same culture of care that we would try to promote throughout, because without that, there could be some consistency, some barriers. So for us, I'd say that's probably the biggest thing. And me and the clients where they're at. Every project is one of one, but there is some common threads of expectations in a good way. Hensel Phelps has a brand to have some consistency and some level of care and things that client latches onto, good or bad, they're expecting that same level of experience the next time out. So you might be moving your own benchmark in a good way. You're moving it up the echelon to be a preferred contractor of choice, but you can't let your guard down. And so making sure what that client experience is expected, that we can communicate across regional boundaries, because otherwise it gets lost.
That's great. Well, Brian, I've really appreciated your being here and always a great conversation. Great to talk with you. I do have one final question before you run. What question are you wrestling with most right now?
What does smart growth mean? So we always have the saying right now, as we're growing, no one company wants to have exponential growth if the resources and the process and everything doesn't stay aligned with it. So one thing we say quite often is, do you want to be the biggest or do you want to be the best? And so for us, it's a question that I wrestle with constantly because it's something I always put myself up against. I look myself in the mirror and say, is this a situation where we're just trying to grow bigger to be bigger? Or are we trying to expand in a smart growth way to make sure that we're being aligned with what we're trying to accomplish? And so 15 years from now, there'll be $40 trillion worth of construction work ready to go without the people to do it. And so there's going to be a point in time where if you align with the right markets and the right clients with the right people, that you should be well on your way to being in the direction you want to go. I guess that's what I leave you with.
Brian, thank you again. Really appreciate your time, your insights, and being so good to be here.
I appreciate it, Scott. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of FMI's Built In. If this episode got you thinking differently about strategy, about managing growth, or leadership at scale, there's plenty more where that came from. Please hit like or subscribe and share Built In with someone in your network who'd appreciate these kinds of insights. Until next time, thanks again for listening.